From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We are on track to spend $2.5 billion more than we bring in over the next 6 months. We expect to end the calendar year in December with approximately $10 billion in unpaid bills, which is about $3 billion more than we had last year at the same time. And moving forward, we expect state payment delays to increase to about 6 months or longer.
That's Illinois Comptroller Leslie Munger. She says the state deficit's going to continue to grow even with that stopgap budget approved. The bill backlog could grow as high as $10 billion by this time next year. Also, some news on the education front in Illinois. We'll discuss that and more today. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. And our panel today includes Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio reporter. Dusty Rhodes, she covers education for IPR. Also joining us today, Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and Mike Riopel, political editor for the Daily Herald newspaper. Chris and Mike, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah.
Well, Brian, let me start with you. Leslie Munger, she's laying out the state's financial picture after this temporary six-month stopgap budget was approved. What was she trying to get across with this message?
More bad news for a change of pace. Basically, her message is that this is not in any way a balanced budget. This doesn't solve the problems of Illinois. You can't just pass a spending plan without actually raising the money that's needed to pay for the things that the spending plan is supposed to cover. So she says that the backlog of bills, right? So basically the way the state has kept itself afloat is by delaying payments to people who, say, provide food to prisoners in the Illinois prisons and gas and road salt to the Department of Transportation, things like that. They have delayed payments to those providers, sometimes for months at a time. If you're a physician who takes care of state or university employees, you might be waiting a year. We've heard that dentists can wait 18 months for reimbursement for taking care of state employees. So this so-called backlog of bills was very high. It grew and grew after the last Great Recession. Then with the income tax increase, it started to go down. Now that we've gone a few years later and had this the income tax increase expired, and nobody in state government has really put through cuts or additional taxes to make up for that, this backlog is growing and growing, projected to hit $10 billion by the end of the year.
Chris, let me go to you because there are probably people sitting out there going, wait a minute, they passed a budget. That's good news, right? How could they see this deficit continue to grow and grow even when they have a spending plan in place?
Well, a spending plan doesn't necessarily mean it's covered by I could lay out a spending plan for my trip to Guadalajara, and that would look nice. But if I don't have the money in the bank to pay for it, that could be a problem for my credit card. And that's exactly what's going on here. Frankly, I'm really glad that she came out with this because, you know, the sort of low-level euphoria after they passed the stopgap budget a couple of weeks ago needed to be tamped down and tamped down quick because really, in my opinion, it was actually a problem to pass that because it does exactly what we've been doing for years, and that is to avoid the problem, push it off, let's not deal with the hard questions that we have to deal with. And that's, in fact, the story of this whole 18-month budget problem, which is now going to go to 2 years and maybe 3 years, maybe 4 years. Who knows? It's just ridiculous.
Well, Mike, I would think there might be also a little political motive behind her coming out. Of course, she is up for election. It's that special election caused by the death of Judy Bar Topinka. She was appointed to fill that, and she's on the ballot this November. She's probably going to be hearing from vendors, I'm guessing, saying, hey, wait a minute, they passed a budget. Where's my check?
Yeah, I think she will, and so will all the legislators, and so will the governor. And it makes you think that, well, maybe the election becomes a referendum on what to do next, taxes, cuts, etc. Makes you think maybe there's going to be some kind of post-election reckoning where you need taxes or cuts or something. Or you might predict that after the election, we'll expect something big to happen and it will get drawn out yet again for who knows how long because it's going to be difficult to do whatever it is.
Yeah, so, and what's going to be different after November? That's the thing that, you know, we'll do it after November. And the governor came out the other day and said, oh, that's how we do things. We get it done in the lame duck session. I mean, that's lame in itself to say that, because the problem's not going to be any more easy to solve. It's going to be harder to solve. Plus, you're going to have the next 4 or 5 months tens of millions of dollars, probably $100 million being spent bashing each other and saying how awful each other. Then they're going to come around the second week of November and say, hey, yeah, let's get it together and compromise and do the hard thing that needs to get done. I just don't see that happening.
You have to ask yourself, are the Democrats more likely to go for the anti-union planks in the governor's platform that have really been the main sticking point for them, or the pro-business things that a lot of people think they could probably get a deal done if it hadn't been tied to the budget the way the governor wanted to do? So if you can't imagine that the Democrats are suddenly going to decide to abandon their union allies, who conceivably are going to be responsible for helping them with whatever victories they're able to amass this fall through fundraising and door knocking and walking precincts and that sort of thing, then, yeah, it's not – I have no reason to be more optimistic that anything's going to get done after the election than would get done now.
And I would add that, you know, Democrats are supposed to be the ones for raising taxes, but you're going to have in the Chicago suburbs a lot of Democrats who are most likely going to run and tell their – constituents, their voters, that they're against raising taxes. They want to get this figured out. So then you would end up having them come back to Springfield and immediately ask them to flip-flop on that. I think that's what happened the last time. You know, that causes a problem. It's not hard to imagine that happening again.
There's also a point here that the longer we wait, and Chris, you alluded to this a little earlier, the longer we wait, the harder it's going to be, the higher taxes are going to go. It's like every few months, you can add on a couple of tenths of a percentage point to what the eventual income tax rate is going to have to go up to. And so, my goodness, you suggested, and we've heard other people suggest, if we are going 2, 3, 4 years with this, are our tax rates going to have to double eventually? I mean, it's really difficult to foresee how high that could have to go to ultimately solve this problem.
And Leslie Munger did not necessarily argue for or against any specific plan. She has said, I believe in the past, though, that both she feels that both cuts and some type of revenue increase are needed.
That's what's so interesting here is basically everybody agrees that we need, as the House Speaker Michael Madigan was the one who started saying it a lot, we need a combination of cuts and new revenue in order to solve the problem. That's basically where the governor is. He says we need cuts and he'll agree to revenue. He won't say what. So pretty much everyone agrees on what the outline of the solution is going to look like. It's just a matter of the numbers, and it's a matter of the political will to vote for it yourself, or if you're a leader, to twist your members' arms and put them in potential electoral jeopardy by voting for these things.
Leslie Munger's job is basically to write the checks, pay the bills for the state of Illinois. It's sort of like the offensive lineman in a football game. The only time you hear the name, something bad has happened usually, So we've been hearing from her quite a bit over the past few months talking about the bill backlog and how that problem continues to grow. She was not the only one, though, this week that there was some news made regarding this stopgap budget and problems it could create. Brian, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability came out with a report as well.
Yeah, it was a legislator named Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills. He's a Republican. He had requested this analysis.
And he voted against the stopgap budget.
And he did. I talked to him that day that was voted on, and he said that this is not solving the problem. It's not a balanced budget. It's a lot of the same points that Chris was making a few minutes ago, that this just sort of kicks the can down the road to the nth degree. And so basically this analysis says, and we should say, maybe if people aren't familiar with it, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, which a lot of people in Springfield abbreviate as COGFA, this group is nonpartisan. They're kind of the budget gurus of the state legislature, and their analysis shows that Illinois is going to spend, if it presumably continues on pace that it is now, $8 billion more than it will spend now. To put that in a little bit of context, the half year that the income tax increase expired, we spent, $2.5 billion more, and then it was, I believe, $5 billion more the next year, and in this coming year, $8 billion more. So this deficit just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
And that's spending $8 billion this fiscal year more than we're taking in. That's what we're talking about. So we're overspending by $8 billion. And to put that into context, I'll probably get the exact number wrong, but the ballpark figure for the annual operating budget in fiscal year 15 was, I think, $34 billion. So we're talking about overspending by 25% every year.
Yeah, that's quite a trip to Guadalajara if you're using that analogy.
I don't know where you stay, Chris. We'll figure that out. Well, we're going to turn now to the education front. Dusty Rhodes, I told you we would get to you eventually here. A couple of announcements were made this week. Let's start with the PARC test for high school students. I thought this was going to be the standardized test to end all standardized tests. A lot of people thought this was a great thing. A lot of people did not. And now the state has made a decision on the future of it.
Well, that only applies to the high school test. The grades 3 through 8 will still be doing PARC. The high school dropped it because multiple reasons, but one of them is that it wasn't like you couldn't say all ninth graders take the test. It wasn't tied to a grade. It was tied to courses. And since in high school kids go through different courses at different times, it wreaked havoc on school schedules. The other thing is that they've replaced it with SAT. Now, keep in mind that it wasn't so long ago that the State Board of Education voted to give our contract to SAT instead of ACT. And I remember seeing a flurry of bills filed to, get back onto ACT or to fund both of them. Or there was some resistance to switching to SAT because we've always done ACT. And so I think that maybe this is a spoonful of sugar to make that medicine go down, that, you know, hey, you're going to do SAT, but you're not going to have to do PARC. So, but in the lower grades, it's still our only statewide test, the PARC test. Now, anybody listening that has kids in grades 3 through 8, they will still probably be taking a bunch of other standardized tests because that's what we do, but that's varies by district.
Why did it happen now? Was it because of this SAT change? You're saying that could have been one of the reasons, or was it just such an outcry about PARC that they decided to go this route?
I think it was because ESSA, the new form of No Child Left Behind, mandates a grade-wide test in high school. So to meet the requirements of ESSA, they needed to have that. And, PARC was also not really recognized as a college entrance exam, whereas the SAT is. So this meets the requirements of ESSA.
That's a lot of alphabetical
terms
there, right?
Every Student Succeeds Act.
Right. Let me also move on to another topic on education, and that was the governor making an announcement this week of a legislative task force, basically, that will start meeting on school funding. What will this consist of, and what's the goal for it?
Well, let's not get this task force mixed up with the task force. This is a commission. Now, I mean, I think they're going to run out of synonyms for groups to get together and talk about how to fund education. So what was your question?
basically, what will it do?
What will it do? Well, I think what it's going to do is tell us that we're going to implement the so-called evidence-based model. That's not what it says it's going to do. It says it's going to debate how to change the school funding formula, which we've said on this program how many times it's tied to property taxes. It's overly reliant on property taxes. That makes it very inequitable. But all signs by the people appointed to this commission and, you can tell by the governor's own words. He said that his personal bias is in favor of the evidence-based model.
And what is that exactly? I mean, can you talk more about what evidence-based model is compared to, other proposals that have been out there?
That's a good question. One reason that it's called the evidence-based model is because it hasn't been filed as legislation, really, by the people promoting it. It's been filed in the House by Will Davis, but we don't call it the Davis bill like we call the Menard bill the Menard bill. It has a list of 27 metrics.
Like smaller classrooms, for example, right?
Yeah.
Things like that.
Like
class sizes.
Right. Like student-teacher ratio. It's kind of some of the things that school districts were doing before they lost money and couldn't afford to hire, keep all those teachers.
Is this... sort of a dispute that's like, okay, that's we're going to get the fig leaf to say that we should do the Republican plan versus the Democratic plan, or is it the suburban plan versus the downstate plan? Or, I mean, can you divide it that way between what this evidence-based model is and what some of the competing proposals are?
Well, Will Davis is not a Republican, right? So, when it was presented to the Education Task Force, the first name on the list of, on the PowerPoint was Ed Red. That's an advocacy group that's made up of the wealthiest districts. It's really supported a lot by suburban districts that stood to lose funds under the Menard plan.
So that which was the competing plan that would have directed more money based on poverty, right?
Well, yeah, and it would have done so by taking some money from the wealthier districts that have high property values. Yeah.
So once again, this commission, I'll call it, is going to be meeting, and they're going to come up with a recommendation by sometime early next year. Now, just because the governor wants something or a commission or task force has been formed certainly doesn't mean anything will eventually happen with it. But basically, I'm guessing this will either push the legislation you talked about, most likely, the evidence-based plan, or some hybrid of that, and that could be coming up next year, spring session for the legislature.
I think something will happen, and I'm basing that strictly on the fact that people don't want to keep supporting the current formula. It, when you run money through it, it the way it comes out is just too embarrassing. You know, you give more money to wealthy districts and poor districts, dirt poor districts lose money, and that's just people can't keep doing that. So there's a real effort to get off that formula.
And Chris, before we move off this topic, I mean, this has been out there for so long, trying to change the school funding formula for Illinois. Why is it so hard to do that?
Well, number one, it's super complicated, and that's probably not why, it's hard. I mean, that's part of it, but that's not where – it doesn't have to be that complicated. It's gotten complicated over the years because of various considerations, and you've got a lot of interests involved. But mainly it's hard because you're talking about especially when you're talking about a zero-sum game, when you've got a pot of money and you're going to divide it up. If you're going to change that formula, there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And they talk about printout I forget the term, but it's the kind of thing where they'll just run a printout when in the legislature. They'll just say, okay, here's what your district's going to get, and here's where you're going to lose, and if they can't get it so more people gain than lose, it's not going to pass, and that's tough when you don't add more money.
And it's easier sometimes to not take a vote if somebody's going to lose, even if some will
Absolutely.
Gain, because you can at least just kind of keep status quo.
Right, so. And you're not on record as being for this thing that's going to take your district, take money away from your district. That's a tough thing.
Mike Riopelle, you cover a lot of suburban districts and education in that area. So I guess it's your fault that nothing has happened. Is that right?
Well, I agree with Chris that that losers in every case cause a problem. When you talk about tax breaks, people be against it because you're creating winners and losers. In this case, people are against it because you create winners and losers. Anytime you disrupt the status quo in a way that's going to put some people behind whatever the formula pays out now, that's going to be a political problem. That's the same problem, as Chris said, around this issue that's existed forever. The added complication now, I think, is that to not create losers, you have to add money. And our whole first part of our conversation here has been about how there's no money.
Right.
So you add that really tough discussion about the budget. So add this really tough discussion on top of it, and that just makes everything harder to do.
And I have to add here that every time winners and losers comes up, the people who have been losing all this time jump up and say, we already have winners and losers. It's always us.
That's right. And there, it's a strong and well-documented psychological phenomenon in human beings that losers always shout louder than winners, and you feel the loss of something much more deeply than you feel the gain, the win from something. And so that's just a terrible cycle.
So in this case, if you had a district, say, with two swimming pool facilities and they're going to lose one versus the district that had to close down its sports and band program, you might hear more from the people who are losing one of the pools as opposed to the one where, you know, presumably the parents don't have time to come to Springfield and lobby if, you know, in an area where it's just completely cash-strapped and very property poor.
Did want to save a few minutes here at the end to talk about a big event coming up next week, the Republican National Convention. The Democrats are the following week. This convention for the Republicans is in Cleveland, but like me, many of the top Republicans in the state will be staying here in Illinois.
Chris, are you one of the top Republicans in the state, Sean? Is that
well,
what you're saying?
I guess I could be. I'll be here just like they are. Chris, this is a bizarre scene, I think. Though, I mean, having gone to these before, you always have some people who don't go to a convention, but for the governor, for a sitting U.S. senator who's facing a tough reelection to not be there says a lot about what's going on within the party.
Right. And well, it says a lot, especially about what's going on in Illinois. I mean, the Illinois Republican Party, I think, doesn't know what to do about Donald Trump. They're, you know, this is a conversation that's playing out all over the country. And they're saying, how does he fit in? What does it mean to be associated with him? What does it mean to not be associated with him? What if he wins and we haven't backed him? And what does that mean for us? And clearly, I think the polling numbers of Donald Trump are very, very, you know, very low in Illinois, probably as bad as any place in the country just about. And so when you've got, you know, that going on, they're going to want to shy away from it. I think Bruce Rauner in particular has a very good reason not to get too close to Donald Trump because people might mix them up, right? They're both sort of political neophyte, mega millionaire business sharks. I don't think he wants to have that image.
Brian, it's been interesting to hear Rauner because I did hear him a couple of times come out and be a little negative on some things Trump said at different points. But for the most part, he really just shies away from talking about it. He's not trying to distance himself like Mark Kirk has done and really go on the attack. He's really just sort of said, I'm not talking about it. I guess that way it could easily get him mixed up more because he's not really saying anything.
I don't know. I think his strategy seems to be working for him. He just simply refuses to ever really address the topic. He's a very disciplined in terms of his political communications, it's very difficult for reporters to try and trip him up. He's always able to sort of bend the conversation and the question. What's that advice they always give politicians? Don't answer the question you were asked. Answer the question you wish you were asked. And so somebody might ask him about Trump and he'll just say, I'm not talking about that. But why we need reforms in Illinois is because of XYZ. And so he has denounced some of the individual things Trump has said about banning Muslim immigration. I'm not sure if he specifically addressed Trump's comments about Latinos, but I mean, basically, he has said the tenor of the Trump campaign statements are pretty terrible. And he also at one point said, I'm the head of the Republican Party in Illinois. I'll support the nominee. But since then, he has just tried to say as little as possible about Trump. And, you know, if reporters don't keep asking about it, if they don't keep, you know, it's difficult for a reporter to justify to her editor or news director to keep doing a story that says the governor refuses to say anything right about Trump day 44. So it seems like, you know, it could be a winning strategy for him to keep his distance.
And Mark Kirk has not been that way. He's been a lot more outspoken. And Mike, you have covered Mark Kirk. And have you talked to him about what his reaction to Trump is?
Well, I agree that Kirk has been way more outspoken about Trump starting about a month ago, where he had kind of waffled back and forth on Trump and then about a month ago tried to make a clean break.
And Trump has been outspoken to Kirk as well.
When Trump met with the U.S. Senate Republicans, I think a week ago, he singled out Kirk, who wasn't in the meeting, and called him a, quote, loser. So there's no love lost there. I think the difference in response between the two guys partly has to do with Kirk is about to share the ballot with Donald Trump. Rauner is sharing the ballot with him more indirectly.
Right.
He's not up for reelection, but what happens to state house candidates down the ballot is very important to the Rauner agenda in the next 2 years. So Kirk's not going to the convention. I think you'll just continue to see him keep hammering away at Trump, and you'll see Democratic Representative Tammy Duckworth, his opponent, keep trying to tie him to Trump. It doesn't matter what he says about Trump. Trump will remain a part of the race.
And go ahead.
So you look back at the emailed statements. We get them every day, multiple times a day from the Duckworth campaign. And you think that they're running against Trump because they try to tie Kirk to Trump so frequently.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Kirk certainly he has got to win that moderate vote. He's considered a moderate senator, and he's got to win that moderate vote. So having Trump on the ballot, that has got to make him very nervous.
Or it gives him a way to try to show he's independent. I mean, the last few months for Kirk have been a lot about trying to show that in some issues. For example, he was the first one who met with Merrick Garland, Obama's Supreme Court nominee. Yeah, I agree. A lot of people across the country are worried about what happens down ballot because of Trump. He's controversial. Do people stay home or do they come out more in droves? I mean, it's going to be an interesting thing for people like Chris to study and the rest of us to have to see how it plays out.
And just about a minute left, Chris, before we move on. Basically, I mean, is that the way you see it as well? I mean, Kirk, this is his biggest challenge here could be Donald Trump as much as Tammy Duckworth?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to separate the two because, Duckworth, as Brian was saying, is going to be hammering him with Trump about the head and shoulders. And his, as was mentioned, he's got to get the moderate vote in order to win the state. And those are the voters, the moderate, the Republicans in the suburbs, especially that classic married mom woman in the suburbs who's a Republican who basically is a swing voter in the state. That's the kind of voter that's going to be thinking to themselves, do I want to vote for Trump? Do I want to vote for Hillary Clinton? Maybe I'll just stay home. And that's going to hurt Kirk if that happens.
We're going to move on now to our notes from the field. Brian Mackey.
Yeah, the Chicago Sun-Times had a story this week about the latest deposition in the red light camera lawsuit going on in Chicago. Some pretty damning allegations in there about, and basically the bottom line is if the plaintiffs prevail in here, Chicago could end up having to refund $200 million in fines and late fees. So yet more good financial news for the state of Illinois and its largest city.
Chris?
Well, speaking of $200 million, one of the ways they got the stopgap budget through was to promise the city of Chicago schools approximately that amount of money, big chunk of money. But it was a contingent on passing a public pension reform plan before the governor would sign it and write the check. I've just to commend some reading to people, I'm just reading a new article written by Eric Medeer, who used to be this chief counsel for Senator John Cullerton, and he writes a very clear discussion of the history and the background of this. Of course, it's he's pushing the Cullerton plan, but I think it's very good. It's in the Illinois Public Employee Relations Report, which is published by the Chicago Kent Law School.
All right. And Dusty?
Well, this is actually breaking news. I'm looking at my Twitter feed, and Amanda Vinicky has just tweeted that Illinois has secured a butter cow sculptor for the year. The previous one retired. And so this is Sarah Pratt of Iowa. We will have a butter cow.
They always come from Iowa. You ever notice that?
All right. What else is there to do in Iowa?
That will do it for this State Week. Members of our broadcast today included Brian Mackey, Dusty Rhodes, Mike Riopel, and Chris Mooney. Remember, you can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.